Today is September 22nd, 2011. This is Jack Crawford, graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin in the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports and Institute for Olympic Studies. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Butch May over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Hi, Mr. May. How are you doing?
Fine. You, Jack?
Great. Where are we talking to you from?
Pardon?
Where are we talking to you?
Well, I pulled off the road because you can't use your cell phone in the car, and I'm at a 7-Eleven store in Fountain Valley, California, Southern California.
Well, thank you for making the time.
I appreciate your time.
So is Butch, is that your birth name?
No, it's Robert. And the joke is the only time I say Robert is when I've been when I get pulled over or if I'm in jail.
It's like, or was that, is that the name your mother would call you if you got in trouble?
Butch? No. A sailor that was killed at the Battle of Midway had touched my mother's stomach in 1941. And said, "Ma'am, you mind if I touch your stomach?" She says, "No." Nope. She says, "It's going to be a little Butch." And, you know, in those days, all the birth mothers got what they got.
That's great. So where were you born?
I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii, November 7th, 1941, month before the war.
Much before the war. And did you, you grew up there?
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, I'm 69 years old. I'm still growing up.
That's awesome. I love that. I think I'm trying to do that as well. So when did you first start getting involved in sport?
In volleyball?
Well, sport.
Or any sport. I was a hamburger all my life. In other words, I had two left feet, couldn't throw, couldn't run. Do you know what a tree stake is?
Yeah.
Right? That's what I looked like when I was a kid. So I was always a kind of a clutch. Last to be picked on any team. There wasn't a softball bat long enough.
So you were tall and skinny?
Nope, just short and skinny.
Short and skinny.
And uncoordinated.
So during what age did you start trying to participate in sport?
Probably when I was younger. I was a third string, third baseman. And let me tell you what that is on a little league team. All you got was a T-shirt. First two teams got uniforms.
So you tried to play a little baseball and
I tried to play football. I weighed 100 and my teammate and I were the two skinniest guys on a high school football team. He weighed 128 pounds. I think I fudged my 131 because we both wore the same pants and we're just the same size. But I figured 131 was closer to 150 than 128.
All right. So that was...
And I graduated, I weighed 136 pounds, so you can imagine how skinny I was.
Yeah. And were you... Because it looks like you're like 6 foot, so...
I was 6 foot, and in taping... You know how football players tape their socks up, how they go around their calves?
Yeah.
I used to run the tape up my legs.
To hold them up?
I just stole my socks up, yeah. And they were stretched socks. So one size fits all? I don't think so.
So when did you, start getting better positions in sport?
Probably after 18 or 19.
So it was...
I surfed all my life. I was a good surfer. And so you have to have coordination there. And then you become a late grower. I started playing rugby instead of football. and you beast up there. And, you know, rugby's a game played, it's a game for ruffians played by gentlemen. And it's, there's no pads. So you just knock the heck, you do the same thing you do in football, only thing there's no blocking, there's no pad.
Right, so this.
And you get to grow up a little bit faster there.
Yeah. So was that after high school?
After high school, correct.
And did you go to college after that?
I went to Santa Monica College. I went to Fresno State and Santa Monica College. That's where I was introduced to volleyball the right way. In high school in Honolulu, if you told somebody you played volleyball when you're in high school, they used to call it volleyball, and only girls played it. Girls are real good athletes played it. There are a lot of good volleyball players from Hawaii, but they were all older. And, you know, high school kids were never let into that part of the game. You learned other things. You played in the neighborhood. You played softball, baseball, football. Soccer was, are you kidding me? That's it's a terrible sport. So we had no soccer. So it's just football, basketball, baseball. Golf, God forbid, you had to be damn near light in your loafers or skinny like me all the time. You know what I mean? Because they couldn't participate in sports that were contact sports. And tennis, oh, geez, that was a rich man's game. Tennis and golf were just separate because they were nobody had courts near their house. You know, I grew up, my street was the last street to be paved. It was all dirt. And you'd go down, you'd carry your shoes to the asphalt schools. Schools that had asphalt and basketball courts. Why? Because you didn't want to wear out your rubber. You know, in those days, your parents, well, my parents bought me one pair of tennis shoes, U.S. Keds, and that was one to last me the whole year. So you start off with a little bit of tissue paper in the toes, and then at the end of the year, you know, the paper came out. But your shoes were well worn. And, you know, that's the way it was. You know, we didn't know any different.
Right.
So, being skinny, being last to be picked, I stood a better chance surfing because none of those guys could surf.
So, is in college when that's when you started playing volleyball? And so when?
No, I was introduced to volleyball in high school, but they didn't. They only had a little bit of high school volleyball. None in the boys' gym, none in the girls' gym. It was mostly for girls. And, you know, if you went down to the parks, the local Hawaiians would play in the park league. They played barefoot on asphalt or cement. And, you know, they didn't know any different. I grew up with a guy from the island of Hawaii. His name was Peter Pua, P-U-A. And he walked in the gym. He had his slippers on, then he put his, and he played barefoot because he could do that. And we call him the barefoot boy from Lapu'ahoi. That's where he was on the Big Island. And when I had my shoes taken when I came to the mainland, I played barefoot. I played barefoot in the gym. They thought I was nuts. But if you didn't bring your shoes to the gym or you weren't prepared to play, but you were asked to play basketball or whatever, you played with what you brought if you weren't prepared. You played barefoot. And people thought I was nuts. But, you know, there's a difference between nuts and crazy. Crazy I could take. But, you know, we just didn't know any different.
Right. So at what point in college did you, when you're playing volleyball, did you start, you know, I guess getting recognized as being a good player?
In San Francisco, I was doing a lot of surfing, and the waves in the fall are probably the best waves you can get, and it will match waves throughout the world. The only thing, the water is like 52 degrees. Sometimes it drops down to the 40s. My sister's birthday, 1961, 62, it snowed in San Francisco. it snowed. There was 6 inches of snow, and I went surfing, and the water was warmer than the outside temperature.
Wow.
But we had friends that played baseball, but there was a YMCA league, so I got intrigued with playing organized YMCA volleyball. And we had a good team, but there was this team from Southern California, from Santa Monica College. And I knew the coach because I met him over in Hawaii. He introduced me to some players that played in the Air Force. One guy was Neil Eldridge, and he's always been kind of a mentor for me. And Gordon Mute were both Air Force, were both airmen in the Air Force. And they played for the volleyball team, and they were World Armed Forces world champions. And I wanted to be like them. But then you lose touch when you go off and you do other things. I got into rodeo. I used to ride bareback and bulls. And, it was easier to make the transition into other sports after you get hurt. So I got stopped on by a bull. And the doctor said, son, we're going to have to take your leg off. I go, why? Because it stopped your circulation. And so I said, what can I do? He says, you're going to have to stay off of it. You're going to have to keep it elevated for at least a couple of weeks to move all that poison into your body. And he says, can't you play a non-contact sport like volleyball? He didn't say volleyball, like volleyball. And I go, oh, yeah, well, I used to play that whatever. So in San Francisco, the coach that I met, who coached Hickam Air Force Base and the world champion, had moved to San Francisco to coach the Olympic team. And when I saw him, he goes, well, I'm only going to be here 1 year, but if you want to go to school, come down to Santa Monica City College. And that's what I did in 1963. And in 1963, I left my horses, I left everything to go down to San Francisco. And to go down to Santa Monica. And when I went down there, I met a fellow Olympian who won 1964, who would hitchhike all the way from New York City. His name was Ernie Sawara. And Ernie and Rudy, Ernie went to the 64 Olympics. Rudy Sawara was my teammate, 1968. We were rooming together. And DeGroote says, whatever you know about volleyball. And, of course, Ernie and I had a lot of opinions about how good we thought we were going to get. He humbled us by showing us if you understand and learn the fundamentals, you can keep this game for the rest of your life. Well, Ernie made the Olympic team in 64. I was an alternate in 64. So it was Rudy. But Rudy and I went in 1968. And I think because of the fundamentals that Bert DeGroote gave us, it gave us a better chance to understand what athletes do, the good athletes. They all play the same. They have fundamentals. They keep their basics so that they never miss the easy one. And we became, in the five or six skills that you have, we became very adept at doing that. In 1964, Santa Monica College not only won the college championship, not the junior college, they won the junior college, but they won the college championship. But they were one of the teams that was one of the best in the nation. And we're talking about open players, the best players. And we were just that. We had two high school kids, a guy 42 years old. We had a few of us that were just 21, and Ernie Sawara was 19. And we didn't just beat colleges. Mick Haley, who's from University of Texas, taught there. He coaches at, coached there, coaches at USC. We killed him when he was in college. Not beat him, we killed him. We beat Ohio State. We beat Ball State. We beat San Diego, UCLA. There wasn't a school that we couldn't dominate. And we're junior college. And because of that, Al Skates said, no more junior colleges. We're going to have a college championship. It has to be NC2A. And by far, and I attribute that to Bert DeGroote. I think he's in the Hall of Fame, in Polio. He's just, he died a few years back. But, Bert, by far, first of all, he was a track coach. particular, he could set things up so that individually we became better at what we did. We all did the same thing. We all did the same thing. Our second team, which rarely played, when they went in there, they were almost as good as the starters. You know, they were just, we were a force to be reckoned with, and nobody wanted to play us. You know, and, you know, after that, he just says, you can take these skills anywhere in the world. And, you know, thankfully, some of us went on to become Olympic players, good beach players, and probably good coaches, too.
So you were playing on the Santa Monica team and dominating everyone. When did you make your connection to the Olympics?
Well, DeGroote was assistant coach. So okay, now, you don't have to put this in, but the alternates that didn't go in 1964, don't write this in whatever you say. In 1964, the Olympic team that was picked played the alternates. In one exhibition match, they didn't score enough points in a 15-point game. I mean, they didn't score enough points in the three game, it's 3 out of 5, to win a 15-point game. That's how good the alternates were. And then we knew. And DeGroote says, you know, at that time, the way they picked the Olympic team, they took a couple of four from the first team, two from the second team, All-Americans, and then they picked one or two players from the armed services. Then they took players from the East Coast, and that's how they filmed. I mean, kind of worked their team. But like I said, the alternates, we were a bunch of mavericks, and we knew we were good. And we looked around and said, oh, man, we can beat these frogs anytime. But from what I said, don't put that in, okay, because it'll hurt some of the older guys.
All right.
Hello?
All right, okay.
All right?
All right.
But, I mean, that's how good we were. But now here's the conundrum. We started this game in the United States, and we played the way we've always played for years going into 1964. We had no idea that the game had changed internationally. We had no idea. We knew that the Russians were good and some of the European teams were good, but we didn't know how good the Japanese were or any of the Asian countries. So we went there with old ideas, only to be faced with a wall of good volleyball, and we had no concept of what we were doing. They changed the game. And the rules had changed, but we never looked into the rules. We never looked into the rule. We never even played with the ball that they were playing with in 1964 until the second game of the Olympic trials finals. Second game. Other than that, we used All-American. You know, we went in there with the we took a knife to gunfight. And, you know, we looked around and said, what the heck happened? So that we noticed that the Japanese were diving and they were doing these Japanese rolls.
Yeah.
So we practiced that in 1968. And the only one that they liked to let practice, that was me, because I'd ridden bulls and played rugby. So my diving on the floor, you know, it was just, if I didn't break anything, I bruised a lot. I lost a lot of skin. But they said, well, let Butch try it. See what it sounds like. You ever hear a square wheel on a wooden floor? That's what I sounded like. There's nothing smooth to it. But I got more adept at doing it. You know, so I was very diligent in trying these things. So in 1968, when we went to the Olympics, guess what? Nobody's diving and nobody's rolling anymore. They're all diving. So we were always behind. Why? Because we never bothered to see the way the rest of the world was training. So we took a knife to gunfight twice, 1964, 1968. But in 1968, that Olympic team was volleyball team was the only team to beat the Russians. Right. And all we did was we woke up a sleeping bear because they beat the heck out of everybody.
So for since you're on training and preparation, did you do anything, you know, in particular for Mexico City? Were you worried about the altitude or?
Well, we trained in the altitude, but we trained wrong. You know, I say wrong because they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it today. The athletes that train today, they work out 3 or 4 days with their weights, either after their training session or they lighter weights before training session, and then they get in and do their stuff. We ran a lot. I'll tell you one thing: we could outrun any team on at the Olympics in 1968. But we trained wrong. Why? Because we never asked questions. Our coaching staff, the volleyball, the United States Volleyball Association, never bothered to investigate to see what the best teams in the world were doing. Never. If it wasn't for some camaraderie between the Polish team and the American team, we would never have used a couple of words, anaerobics and aerobic. That wouldn't be in our vocabulary. You know, and there was no such thing as sports medicine. You had, I can't think of his name. I'll name it in a second. From Ball State University, was the first to do studies on movement. And movement with emphasis on strength and coordination, speed. And volleyball's got a little bit of each. So as individuals in 1960, nobody trained in 1964. In 1968, we're all individuals because what was good for me might not be good for you. So we trained differently. You know, we some of us did heavy weights. Some of us should have. A couple of the athletes on the Olympic team should never have been on that team. Why? Because they couldn't finish a 2 mile run under 10 minutes. You know, they couldn't do a lot of things. But they were picked because that's just the way the Olympic team was picked. You know, if we're running uphill and there were a bunch of Indians shooting arrows, about one third of that Olympic team would have had a lot of arrows shot in their butt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, that's just the way it was because that's how they picked. You know. How I made the Olympic team, nobody knows. I got in a fight with a player at Echo Summit High School, and he was more worried about his wife making the team so they could be the first husband and wife to make 2 consecutive Olympics. And he wasn't worried about the other athletes. So I said, come on, these are the guys on the team. And he goes, F them. I said, what'd you say? He said, F them. You and I are on the team. So I just hauled off and I cold cocked him, knocked him down. And he was bleeding, sitting on the floor, and everybody said, what happened? I said, altitude. I think it got to him. What did he punch me? I went from 24 guys trying out. I mean, from maybe in the top 5, 6, whatever it is, to number 24.
With one punch.
They said I was incorrigible. I couldn't be, you know, what happened? I'd lost myself insofar as doing this. I thought everybody had the same common Olympic spirit. Some people wanted to go because it was cool to be on the Olympic team. I wanted to go there to play for my country, my family, and you know, the place where I came from. You know what I mean? So everybody has a different attitude in why they wanted to make the Olympic team. I worked very hard. You know, you train very hard. 4 o'clock, and I got arrested for running in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. So what are you doing? Working out for the Olympic team. Oh, yeah, sure. Get in the back of my car. You know, where'd you get all this stuff? Oh, I just moved down from Sacramento. Oh, I know, you stole all of it. You're under arrest. You know, and I, you know, you're telling people that the sacrifices that that we made are much different. They were much different then than they are today. You know, you go through divorces to make the Olympic team, and that happens in probably many other sports. Why? Because wives accept it, then all of a sudden they can't do it anymore. You know, they never see their husband. Or the other way around, husbands never see their wife. We have nothing to, we don't have any manuals on how to train. You know, they do now. They have coaches that are very diligent. They are not only good trainers, they have good eyes for technique, but they also know what you're not doing.
Right.
You know, they can tell. They spot check. These athletes today spot check each other. You know, weightlifters know how much they have to lift. They don't need to lift their maximum weight now. They need to wait for the next tournament or for the world championship, et cetera. And that's how you train. Track and field does that. Everybody, swimmers do that. And volleyball players didn't know how to do that. You know, there's when you're a minor sport, there's not very much respect. And somehow, even with our leadership, I always thought that they had a responsibility. They should have gone out and said, oh, no, this is what we have to do.
Right.
You know, the team might have been different. I don't think, I think a few of the athletes would have been different. But at the Olympic trials, you had guys sneaking out of their camp to go gamble. You know?
To go gamble. And this is in Mexico?
No, this is training for Mexico. They snuck out of camp at North Shore, Tahoe. You're only 11 miles from South Shore, where all the gambling and stuff was. And if you were trying out for the Olympics, your food was free, and obviously the entertainment was more than exciting. And you had a few of those athletes that did that. And the rest of us staying there, you're looking and saying, you got to be kidding me. And the coaches never saw that, or they turned a blind eye. Why? They had their favorite athletes were going to go to the Olympics. And I was more defiant than anybody else. Nobody wanted to come around me.
Yeah.
You know? And then Jim Coleman promised his friend, Jim Vineyard, that he was going to make the Olympic team. Why? Because he was coach. He had the last say. And if you took a look at our running chart, lifting chart, drills, you know, you're testing on your drills, your passing, et cetera. I was always in the top four or five, six. You know? And when I became number 24, it wasn't because I was skill-less or I couldn't run or I couldn't lift. It was because they were afraid I couldn't mix with people. Well, when I saw how some of the players were being treated with, you know, with coaches looking the other way when they were out all night and stuff like that, you know, I didn't say anything. Maybe I should have. But, you know, in Hawaii, now I'm not 131 pounds. I'm 196. And, you know, I just didn't handle a lot of things well. And, you know, when that happened, going down the last day, they had picked their 11 players on the team, and they gave the rest of the team the last vote. And the last vote, I was picked. I was picked last.
Wow.
Not because of my skills, but because if they looked at all the slots that Bill, so I went. And here's what Jim Coleman said, and he was an Olympic coach. He shook hands with everybody on the team except for me. He says, you might be on the team, but who says you'll ever play? And I said, heck, I know he's going to feel different once the Olympics starts. And for the first few matches, three or four matches, I was always in the room by myself warming up. And he just says, stay in the room and warm up. And the match would go on. They beat the Russians, and I never got to see any of it. I use the word we because I like to believe maybe I was on the Olympic team.
Right.
So I never saw that. When we played the Czechoslovakians the next day, Larry Rundle, our best, by far, probably a best all-around player on the team, sprained his ankle. It was bad enough he couldn't go in. The two best passers on the team was Rundle and myself. And he looked down the row, and he wouldn't put me in. And we lost to Czechoslovakia 15-2, 15-0, 15-whatever. And we played Japan. And the Japanese, the same team we made fun of, were so fast that we weren't very adept at doing anything. We had remedial defenses and offenses to everything that was advanced because we never looked into it. So I didn't play there. And then I think we played Bulgaria. Bulgaria, and we need to beat Bulgaria to stay in the medal round, to stay in contention because we'd already beaten the Russians. And we won the first two games. And the third game, we're ahead 12-7, and he puts Wink Davenport in. That's Lindsay Davenport's dad. And to pass the ball. Like I said, Rundle was out for the remainder of the Olympics, and I'm looking, and he said, get back in the room and warm up, so I'm down there. We lose that game, and we're up ahead, and he puts Wink back in, and we lose that game, and we lose the fifth game. And at that time, I said, oh, man. I said, had I known this was going to happen, I would never have quit my job. So I'll go tell the coach, you know, send me home. I can go back and work. I'm okay with that. And when I got up there, I was so, I think I erupted like a volcano. I don't know. It's in Misty's book. You may have heard me say this when you were there at the bank. But I went up there to talk to him. And I opened up my hand. I said, Jim, when I open up my hand, I want you to tell me what's in it. And I held it like a fist, so he was, you know, he stood back a little bit. I opened up my hand. I said, what do you see there? He goes, nothing. I said, that's exactly what you know about coaching. And then I started throwing his clothes out the six-story window. And when he looked out, I hung him out the window. And had I dropped him, I was saying and crying at the same time. I said, if you go out this window, nobody will ever know that you didn't do it on purpose because we lost to the Bulgarians. And I'll tell everybody because you were upset. And that's when Coach Iba, who was a basketball coach, and JoJo White, and a bunch of guys from the basketball team came in and said, I heard my assistant coach said, son, don't do it. You'll never play volleyball again. You know, at that time, you think, if I'm going to do it, who cares about volleyball? Right. So I let those guys, you know, grab a hold of the coach and pull him back in. And he says, you're off the team. And Jim Lowell says, John Lowell said, no, I'll talk to you, Jim. He says, go, and go get packed. I said, I'm leaving. And John said, you're not off the team. You'll finish the Olympics. I go, why would I finish these Olympics? I said, started off on the wrong foot. They picked the wrong coach. They picked somebody that never investigated what the other teams were playing like. I said, I busted my ass. You know, I went through jobs. I did all of these things. I said, for this? I said, this hasn't been a good experience. And he says, you're going to play tomorrow. So now we're playing. Here's how I got to play. Coleman says, you're at the end of the bench. I said, okay. Mike Bright, the captain of the team, walks off the court, so they have to put somebody on. If they call a timeout, we forfeit that game. And he just says, somebody's got to go in. The only person that could go in was me. And he says, well, you tell him. So I went in for Mike Bright, who walked off the court. And on the first play, they sent me the ball, and I dinked the ball. Dinking is just putting it up over a block. Skorik, who was one of the best spikers in the world at that time, spiked my dink. You know what spiking a dink is? It's like handing it to him, and he just broke my thumb. He shattered my thumb. I mean, my small finger. And it was laying over sideways, and he says, your finger. And I said to myself, this is how defiant I was. If I look at it, it's going to hurt. If I don't look at it, it won't hurt. So I told him, throw me some tape. And Joe said, why? I said, throw me some tape. So when he looked, he said, your finger's broken. I said, just throw me the tape. So I wrapped it up and finished the match. We didn't beat Poland, but we played well. And then I played after that. So those first four games, you know, it wasn't a good experience. Everything up to then was horrible on the court. or in, and especially around that team. And you know what two magnets are like? They repel each other, right?
Yeah.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, two magnets are repel each other. And this whole volleyball team stayed away from it. But we went in and we played very well. And it wasn't about me. It was about trying to do something, probably, you know, for the same reason why I wanted to make the Olympics. I wanted to do it so that I could say I was an Olympian. So it was for my family, for my country, and for the place where I came from. And, you know, I could see it with other athletes. And after that, even though Coleman and I never talked after that, he again shook everybody's hand on the team except for mine. And I don't blame him. Because 2 years later, I stopped him in a rush, and I put my foot behind his chair. My wife thought, oh, my God, here it goes. He's going to beat the hell out of Coleman. And I said, Jim, I want to apologize for being the person that I was. I said, I'm not that today. But I said, it's not important that you say it's okay. I just needed to apologize to you. So at that particular time, I cleaned my slate. And that was it. And as far as positive things in the Olympics, the negative things were on the court. Just those three matches, probably three matches. But it was positive after that. And, you know, I played with every one of the guys since. Every one of the guys that I went to the Olympics with. And they looked at me kind of funny. And I was playing a lot of it. And at that time that I played with them, I was playing rugby and also racing motorcycles. So if things got to me on the volleyball court, heck, I never showed it. You know?
Yeah.
But they always knew that maybe my elevator didn't go all the way to the top, or I was one French fry short of a, you know, a large order, whatever it is. But, you know, in a way, that was my Olympic experience. That's, and I only told you the negative side. I never told you the positive thing.
Well, Poland was the first match that you played in?
Poland, yeah.
Poland. And then...
That's because Bright walked off the court.
Right.
Forfeit or finished the game, and I went in there.
And then did you play against GDR?
Yeah. Yeah. Played GDR.
So
Tunisia. Mexico.
With Poland and
Brazil.
Oh, in Brazil. With Poland and GDR, was there anything, you know, different or, you know, about playing, you know, the Soviet bloc teams?
Oh, the GDR, probably the best balanced team out of all of them. You know, we thought it was going to be GDR against Russia, but it ended up Czechoslovakia, so we thought it was going to be a war. No problem. The Russians quelled that. But Poland by far was class, you know. In all respects, they beat you, but they didn't toy with you. Russia was kind of taken back because they made mistakes waiting for us to fall through the floor. You know, we had never done that well, but we played in a different place. We played in the Ice Palace. They changed our match. So it was more of an advantage for us because Russians weren't used to low ceilings. And, you know, we just beat them in five. You know, that was, but the Japanese were good. Mexico, we got, you know, Brazil. You know, we had the chance to be in the medal round. Not saying we would have had a bronze medal, but we had a chance to be in the medal round. I think that's what upset me. And then when he said, Wink's mom was leaving, and she wanted to see Wink play in the Olympics. And I went, oh, my God. I said, that's the reason why you would sacrifice a win just so Wink's mom could watch him play. Yes. And that's when I lost it. You know, so,
yeah.
I think, I don't discovered guilty prior to investigation.
Do you think that, the Soviets and Poland and GDR, do you think that their success was due to, you know, the differences, I guess, in the theories about amateurism and...
No, the way they trained. You know, most of the Soviet players were all soldiers, so they did the same thing that Hickam Air Force did when they won the World Championships, U.S. World Championships, for Armed Force World Championship. You were an airman for 6 months out of the year, and you were a volleyball player for the other 6 months. You know, so there's, and GDR did it, Poland did it. You know, they took the best of the best. We took the first four off the winning team, two off the second team, or sometimes they took six in the winning, four from the second team, and then two picks. One was a YMCA champion, the other was a four champion. And they weren't always good picks. You know, like I said, in 64, our team beat the heck out of the Olympic team. Why would you send the Olympic team? You know, but that's just the way it was at that particular time. You know, now the athletes, you can't be 6'5 and dominate. 6'5, you're a little guy. You know, they have 7-footers. Russia's got two or three guys that are 7 feet. Poland's got two guys 7 feet. You know, we can match up to them because we have a couple of guys that are 6'9. You know? Right. But that's the closest we got. We don't have any 7-footers. The emphasis, volleyball is big, is the second biggest sport in the world. Soccer football is number one. Volleyball is number two. Basketball, number three in the world. And the players that are very gifted are chosen when they're 10, 11, 12 years old. They don't wait till they're teenagers when they have, other interests. The United States has been very blessed by keeping teams together and working. But internationally, if you play, you make all your money internationally. These guys make a triple six figures. Right. You're playing volleyball. You don't get that here. You make $2,500, $3,000 a month if you're on the Olympic team and you're at the Air Force Academy or down here training. That's not a lot of money.
Nope.
You know, and it's even tougher for sand volleyball players. Everybody thinks, oh yeah, they make a lot of money. No, they don't. There's only room at the top for the winners. You know, Misty and Carrie have been very, very blessed. They make double six figures or whatever. Okay, but you've got indoor volleyball players that play internationally that make $300,000 or $400,000 a year. And they stay. They stay in Russia. They stay in Brazil. They stay in Italy. They stay in Turkey. You know, to make that money, you need to stay there 11 months to bring that money home. No tax. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know. So you know, everybody. You know, how do you get? Have you ever been to Utah?
Yes.
Salt Lake.
Yes.
Okay. Right where the temple is, everything's built like a wagon wheel. Almost all the streets will get you to the temple. You know what I mean?
Right.
Well, there's more than one way to get to the gold medal. You know, there's no one way, but athletes train differently. Misty was introduced by one of her players that she played against in China for a couple of Olympics. Feifei, who's got 15-year-old girls that are 6'5", and 17-year-old girls that are 6'7", playing beach ball. That's big.
Yeah, that's tall.
You know? But they get their directions early, not late. And everybody wants to be a Kerry Walsh. Well, not everybody can be a Kerry Walsh. You know, Kerry Walsh is a Kerry Walsh. That's it. I want to be a Karch Karai. Nope, there's only one Karch. You have to go out and whatever it is, whether it's track and field, you know, who cares what sport? you have to remember. You ever hear of a guy called Dan Gable?
No, I haven't.
Okay, he's a wrestler, won the gold medal, beat the Russian. The Russian was undefeated for a couple of years. Dan Gable beat him. Dan Gable moved out of his out of the university his last year, even though he had one more year to go, and he went home. And his dad would hear him pounding weights at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. He goes, what are you doing? He goes, what if the Russians doing this? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? So he went beyond. If everybody's telling you they work for work out 2 hours, they work out three. You know, you don't tell them to work out three, but you work out three. If they're running that extra mile or the extra sprint, then you do five or six more. Why? So you can be one or two steps ahead of everybody that you're with. You know, I grew up with very privileged to know Al Order. He won 4 gold medals and 4 Olympics. His discus. Started first one at 16 and last one at 32. Yeah, 16 and 32. Hal Connelly threw the hammer. Gold medalist and silver medalist. Died just recently. And I knew those men. And when I walked in the gym, they looked at me and said, what are you doing? So working out for volleyball. I got 100, I'm squatting with 235. These guys are doing stuff with 450, 500. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They go, volleyball. Yeah. Is that going to be in the Olympics? They go, yeah. And they, you know, so I kind of upped it. And they laughed a little bit. But the gym that they were working out in was the original Joe Gold's gym. He was a good friend of mine. He said, you make the Olympic team, you'll never ever pay for a Gold's gym again. And that was my goal, not to never pay again, but to make the Olympics. And because I did that, Joe says, as long as I have my name on a gym, it's free. You know, I mean, these are some of the privileges you get probably through conversation, or it's a gentleman's agreement. But to watch those athletes work out, Hal Connelly was born with a short arm. You know, and when he was pressing 425, 475, that short arm went up first before his big arm, his normal arm. And that impressed me. You know, there's things in your life when you see athletes work out that just knock your socks off. You know, you look at the football player today. Football at the highest level, whether it's University of Texas or it's college level, is all year round. You know, when you're off, you get to rest your muscles, do some stretching, and you know, heal. But you're really working out, even though your workouts are lighter. So you're really prepped going into your first practice.
Right.
And it's like that for swimming. You know, Jim Ryan said it a long time ago that, you know, I talked to Jim in St. Louis, and he says, you know, he didn't win a gold medal. He tried twice. And he was favored. And the press in Kansas wrote, when he got off the plane, only second. You know, that's that kind of lives with you for a long time. You know what I mean?
Right.
And he says, no, he accepted that, but it became better for that. You know, he realized that if he could relax with all the poo-poos and all the rest of the stuff, that heck, it wouldn't be fair. You know, so what he did was he just, he went on. He picked himself up and went on to become senator, became a preacher, you know. And he walks the walk, talks the talk, you know, all of which is good.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, I was overly impressed because my experiences. You know, the bad stuff I told you, that happened on a one-on-one. You know, but overall experience, I had to tell Misty about it, and I wanted to tell my wife about it. And you know something? Because I didn't win a gold medal, the only thing that hurt me all my life until I talked to Tom Loft, said, no, you made the Olympic team. And I remember what Jesse Owens said, that everybody here is a winner, but on a given day there's only one champion. And I met lots of champions, lots of gold medalists. And every time I see the U.S. win another gold medal, or I see athletes that struggle, whether it's a Special Olympics, whatever it is, I feel so good that I cry. And I go like this, man, that's part of it. You know, because I didn't win a gold medal, or because of some of the things, it doesn't mean like I shouldn't appreciate what I had. You know, I'm more grateful and thankful today. You know, I just thought that you went to the Olympics and the only people that talked to you, that talked to anybody from the Olympics, were just a gold medalist. No, you help other people. You can imagine, okay, with the type of foundation that I had at the Olympics, right, with doing that to Jim and the rest of the team, who do you think had to work her way through that? And I apologized to her a long time ago. It was Misty. Misty had to do that. Jim Coleman came to watch Misty play indoor once and said, I know she's a good player, but too bad she's short. And he picked the shorter girl for the Olympic team.
Oh.
Because they were always afraid that Misty was going to be just like me. And I always apologized to her for, she had to walk through all my dirt and become her own person. And I'm thankful for that. You know, she's getting her master's, and she gets to talk to young athletes that want to be just like her. And Missy says, whew, you got lots of work. You know, and Rafer Johnson told Missy, he said, when you win a world championship, your life changes. But when you win a gold medal, your life's never the same.
Right.
You know, how do you figure that?
All right.
You know, sometimes when Misty doesn't want to do something, I'm the first to throw that right in her face. And she goes, I know, Dad, I know. So I go, you want to be and you know something? I'm proud. I'm proud not because I'm her dad. I'm proud because she's an Olympian that she's good for women who want to get into sports. She's good for athletes that have struggled, that have had a lot of adverse things. She's got tore Achilles. She had a lot of things happen to her, but she picked herself up, and she just continued. Now, for her, she wasn't afraid to listen to people say, oh, well, she's short. And she goes, Dad, what do you think I ought to do? I said, play tall. You think you're short, just play tall. And, I think she exemplifies everything that everything that an Olympic athlete could do.
Yeah.
You know, she's, and she's not standoffish like a lot of the athletes on the 68 Olympic team. You know, you got some guys that still have big heads. I mean, it was fun sitting there listening to George and George the Fourth, to listen to the story. And of course, he goes like this. He says, boy, you next to crazy. You know? Are you still there?
Yeah.
You know, to George, I said, I know. I said, George, this is like a confession. He goes, well, he says, if you got to talk to somebody, I'm 24/7. And I knew he meant that. And you know, sometimes maybe that's what sometimes it's just what some of the athletes need to do. You know, they get so focused on the sport, they forgot that they forget to learn how to live. I mean, I have a good time. You know, when I see the fellow Olympians, I can see Hines, I can see all these other guys. I can see their wrinkle-free bodies. I mean, that's what an impression they left with me. I can see wrinkle-free bodies, lifting, running, punching, swimming, doing all of that. And then when I get to listen to them talk, I don't see any wrinkles. And I don't know if I'm getting old or if I'm getting blind. You know, I just I know some of the stories, and you know, we're just humans doing instead of just being humans being. You know, that's all they were, and they're good examples. You know, I'll give you an example. Jim Ryan and one of the boxers, his name was Jackson, wanted to talk to me after the 68 Olympics. And they said, we need to ask you something. I go, yep. We saw the interview with NBC. Go, yeah. And you're not very complimentary to your daughter. I go, oh, really? I said, how do you know? It's just because you never compliment her. Oh, okay. That's what NBC said. Well, that's all the snippet that you saw. When you have thousands of people out there, you know, Misty's job as a volleyball player, as a beach player, is to be an athlete on the court. When her job is to pass, set, hit, dig, block, you know, do all the things. That's her job. That's why athletes work out. The thing that she does, if it's absolutely outstanding and it hasn't been done by anybody else, and Misty always has a few per game or sometimes in a match, that's when I yell out, lucky. Lucky carries over any cheer or nice going, Misty. She can hear the lucky, and she knows that's my compliment. You know, DeGroot always told us, this is your job. You know, if you're going to play volleyball, then you practice your skills. You don't have to be complimented or patted on the back every time you do something well, because that's your job. And we all knew what he meant after we started having our own victories. When we started beating all the good teams, we all wanted to say, oh, did you see me put that ball down? Or did you see that? No, it was a team effort. Why? Because the team practiced for that. At practice. You know, we did all the things necessary. So DeGroote says, you don't need any compliments. The compliment is, you did what we practiced, and we won as a team. And, you know, Misty kind of understood that. I can't compliment her for things that she does over and over again, thousands of times or hundreds of times. But I can compliment her for things that she's really outstanding with. And so once, I think Ryan and Jackson kind of understood that. They goes, oh, I understand. That wasn't in the interview. I said, a lot of it never is. So I'm not so bold, and I'm not so, I'm really kind of a paper tiger, I guess.
Yeah. Hey, can you take me back to Mexico City a little bit? There were a few kind of events going on that I'd like to get your take on. Did you know about the there was a student massacre that happened in Mexico City?
Well, the student massacre happened because the pyramids that were part of the Olympic Village had gold and a lot of artifacts in it, and the city government and the military were taking those things, and the students actually wanted to say, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, that was only part of it.
And so did you see any, like, increased security measures or anything in the city or the Olympic Village?
Listen, they gave all the federales guns. The worst thing that they did was they gave them ammo. You know what I mean? Guns right. Enough just put fear in everybody. But as soon as they gave them the ammo, that was it. You know, you ever watch, if chickens see blood, they all attack that chick or that chicken that has that's bleeding. That's what they do. So the first time the bullet went off, everybody started shooting. There were a couple of Hawaiian people that came to the Olympics that were shot because they looked Mexican or Spanish. And, you know, they said, what? You got to get in here. I mean, it was a peaceful thing. There was just, you know, voices. There wasn't anything thrown, nothing.
Right.
That's as far as it got. You know, we were told to stay away from there. And then we found out from the students that the site that we were on were pyramids that were being looted by their own government.
Huh. So you were going out doing a little sightseeing?
Well, you know, after that, you want to stay away.
Yeah.
You know, when your schedule, you're playing your matches, you have pool play, and then you play, everybody's going to play. You've got your pool play to get in the qualifier, and then you finish that out. You got, you know, 11 days to play your 8 matches or 9 matches. So you got a couple of days off, evening off or whatever. When you're on the losing end, you start the party. You know, I made a cruel comment. If I wanted to go to see Mexico, I'd drive to Santa Ana. That's where I live. You know, you don't need to go to Mexico to see what Mexico is like, because the Mexicans had covered up all the poverty. I cried. I left most of my USA stuff there. You know, you take jerseys home because you covet them and everything. And you know, it's one of those things that I saw people there that didn't have anything. Every cent that I had, I gave away. That's the first time I had ever seen poverty. I mean, I was poor all my life, but I had never seen people who couldn't afford something that they needed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, that's the stuff that got me. And then after that, it just kind of progressed to 1969 after the Olympics. We went down to Central America and South America to play down there. And then you start putting this poverty stuff together. The banners and stuff that they had around the Olympic site was just to cover up the poverty. That's all.
Mm-hmm. So what did you think about any of the civil rights issues? I guess there was an Olympic project for human rights by the Harvard crew, and they sent out a letter. Did you see that? Or
No, I never saw that.
Okay. And then there was Smith and Carlos when they were on the awards.
Smith and Carlos, okay. You know, in 1961, I got arrested because I had my wallet taken in the state of Texas, in Dallas. That's where I saw Smitty Duke, was just getting out of high school. And I said, fell in love with volleyball. I said, oh, man, I want to play like those guys. Even though I played a little bit. So as I was being arraigned, they said, what's your name? I said, Robert May. He said, where are you from? Hawaii. And he goes, you're from Hawaii? I go, yeah. Well, you're a goddamn Negro, aren't you? I go, no, all them Hawaiians are Negros. And I went, excuse me? So that was 1961. I phoned my mom, I phoned her dad, who phoned his two Spencer sisters, who owned the largest paper printing company in the state of Texas, in Fort Worth. And next thing I know, I'm out. And the same bailiff that said that said, why don't you tell me you come from good family? Well, these two Spencer sisters gave up, I think, $28 million to the University of Texas. They both died a couple years later. But I went down there for a tournament, and years later, same thing happened. You know, and I'm looking, I'm going, things hadn't changed. So John Carlos and Tommy Smith were only doing something. They were trying to be activists in their own rights. You know, I had to play that back. It didn't bother me. I just, it's not what you expect when they're playing the national anthem. You know, but that will live, on for the rest, for the rest of us to deal with. You know, we're better today, but they were doing what they thought they could do. I mean, without shooting anybody, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, they did it the right way. Had John Carlos not been so arrogant and looked to his left as opposed to his right, he'd have won a silver medal. But Tommy and John Carlos have never been to any of the function.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way it is. You know, sometimes your arrogance, I learned there's a difference between humility and humble. Okay. I was at Santa Monica College a few years later when Tommy Smith was the track coach there. Are you still there?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. He was just every bit as arrogant then. You know, so I don't. He said, "You know, people on the '68 Olympic team." I didn't tell him I was on the '68 Olympic team. You know, I just, it's not that I didn't want to associate myself. Maybe we'll have a, there'll always be another time.
Yeah. Well, '68 was the beginning for a lot of things in the Olympics. And another thing was like the beginning of testing for like steroids and performance enhancing drugs, things like that.
Steroids was rampant.
Yeah.
With our team and the international teams. Maybe not our volleyball team, but you could tell track and field. There was a few guys in track and field that had it. But it was one of those things you always ask yourself. Maybe had I tried some steroids, maybe I'd have been a better jumper. You know, you second guess yourself. You know, who knows? But I could sit in the GDR teams, all the guys involved in field events. I mean, they have stretch marks where young kids, they're 19, 20 years old, stretched beyond the, why? Because they had grown. They were BMS. I won't say who looked like a Neanderthal man, but he was on the Olympic team. You know, we had a couple of them. And that stuff, no matter how you try to mask it, would creep up and bite its ugly head years later.
Right. Did you notice any testing going on?
Oh, yeah, we got tested.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah, I was with the Brazilian team. He was so afraid that he peed all over everybody. They wouldn't give us water. In Mexico City, you know, you play a match and you're absolutely lose all your stuff. And they were so ignorant that they wouldn't give you water so you could urinate and take your test. So we're there for an hour and a half, and finally when they gave us liters of water, this guy didn't just do it in his flask. He peed over everybody, on doctors, he was mad. I mean, I can still see him, nurses, everybody. He was just absolutely, and we couldn't get through to him. Why? Because ignorance. You know, Misty gets tested sometimes once a week for 2 or 3 weeks, and then at least once a month. And they'll phone her, and they said, "We red flagged you because you didn't show up." She says, "I'm in front of my house." "Well, we're in front of your house." Misty says, "I own two houses." "What do you own?" "I got one in Florida and one in Long Beach." "Oh, we're in Long Beach." Misty says, "Can you be here in an hour?" And she says, "I'm in Florida." So the U.S., I mean, you know, there's some funny things that go on because they're ridiculous. And they try not to. I've seen right after practice, I said, "Who are they?" "Oh, they're the Goon Squad." The Goon Squad is Misty's way of saying they're from the, I have to take a urine test.
Right.
They come and take it right off the beat. "Can I go down the water?" "No." She's full of sand, and I go, "Hey." And she goes, "Yeah, it's okay." You know, Misty doesn't try to fight anything.
So,
go ahead.
Well, you've talked about Misty a little bit. I was going to ask you, like, what advice would you give, you know, today's Olympic hopefuls? And is that advice that you've given Misty, or would it be different?
I think you're dropping out a little bit.
Would you like me to repeat it? Can you hear me? Hello? Yeah, I was just asking you about, you know, one piece of advice that you would give today's Olympic hopefuls, and you were talking about Misty. I was kind of wondering, would it be the same advice you give her, or what do you think about that?
About Would you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, what advice would you give to today's Olympic hopefuls?
Oh, the hopefuls. Missy says the same thing. You know, dare to fail. Dare to fail. But don't take a knife to a gunfight. Be realistic. If you're short, you're 5'5", and you're a good volleyball player, skilled at doing what you don't be so arrogant and saying, hey, I'm going to make the Olympic team, because there's only one position open. That's to be a libero. Okay, but you're not going to be a hitter. You're not going to go up front. You're not going to do – that's a realistic approach. But she says dare to fail. In other words, she can never tell you what your limits are going to be. You'll know what your limits are. You know, so she encourages everybody. She's the only one that encourages high school kids. How many sports do you play? Three, but they want me to play one. But she says, I'm going to tell you this, and only once only. It's going to tick one coach off. Said, what's that? Play them all.
Play them all.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, I'm going to phone you back. Missy's on the phone. I'm going to phone you right back. All right?
Okay.
Okay. Bye. I tell young athletes, okay, first of all, most of the young athletes will look at me and go like this, he was on the Olympic team? and the neat part about it is the only ones that appreciate it more are really the Special Olympics, because they go like this, you're on the Olympic team, did you win a medal? I said, no, I didn't. By the way, they gravitate to Misty. But they always come back somehow. They just say, do you think I could be on it? And I go, absolutely. You know, because I've seen all shapes and sizes at the Olympics from different countries. And, you know, when I think about it, or I think about some of the stories that I like to share with people, I'm almost teared up. Not so much because I'm nostalgic. It's because I'm... and you get the same feeling again. You get chicken skin, and you really feel good about talking about it. To see Jesse Owens, who was a class act, I can't say more. You know, I kept the signature for a long time, and I don't know what I did with it. To see athletes, where else could you see 4 years of Sports Illustrated but live?
Right.
No place. And, you know, Missy understands that. There's a great feeling when you march in, I mean, there's nothing greater. When she went to the Olympics in 2000, Holly said, we don't have to go to the opening ceremonies because we play the following day. I said, Missy, you're going to go to the opening ceremony. She said, why? I said, you're going to know exactly what it feels like. And she went there, and she never misses it.
Nice. You know, did you go to your opening ceremony?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was right behind Al Order, and I pulled his blazer up over my head. He goes, what are you doing? We're given these newspapers, and they're all in Spanish, right? Yeah, I mean, you're in Mexico, so you got the Mexican news. And I didn't know what they were for. So I said, I'm tired of carrying the newspapers. I'm going to throw them away. So they got... Cal Conley went like this, but you should never throw that away. I go, why? He says, you'll find out. Everybody, all the experienced ones were laughing. But when they let those 100-some-odd thousand white pigeons out, and they're crapping all over the place, now you know why. So I just ducked under Oyer's jacket like an old cameraman, you know, those old photographers.
Yeah.
And he goes, wait, oh, and everybody just got crapped on. And he goes, I told you to keep the newspaper. He had newspaper over his head and his jacket open. And I just pulled his jacket up over me. You know, if he was alive today, he'd go, you son of a bitch. I told you to keep the newspapers.
That's great. Did you also go to the closing ceremony?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I pulled a normal butch. I kept the hat from Czechoslovakia, and it was a special hat that when they had the folk dancing and stuff, they wear that hat. And I knew it. And a guy from Senegal who was just a pest grabbed my hat and threw it off to the audience. Now, you got 100,000 people there. And they grabbed the hat and they kept it. And I kept saying, pass it back, and they didn't. And I followed this guy from Senegal, and he was disrupting. The next thing I know, I tackled him, rugby tackle, and I'm sitting on top of him, beating the hell out of him. And then this one guy says, you know, you got probably close to 40 million people watching this. And he says, is this the Olympic spirit? It melted my heart. So there was good things. I mean, there was just some things. Yeah, I went through the closing ceremony.
That's great. It's been incredible talking with you today, Butch May. Is there anything else that you would like to tell us about?
Well, you know, heck, you can't take back some of the bad things, but you know, there were some funny things. When each hotel, each apartment only had a 5-gallon water heater. And the first guy used to get in there, he got the hot water. So I used to sprint off the bus. And I'd get there, and you wash your vitals, and you try to make sure that everything works. Then I found out the best place to take showers were down in the steam room, you know. And so we did that. And then while everybody was signing autographs, I'd run up to go take a shower. And I signed autographs, and you have 10,000 people out there. Can you imagine 10,000, 8,000 to 10,000 people every day? And, I got your signature. I got your signature. I got you. So then I said, you don't have this signature. And they said, what was that? So they said, what sport? I go, baseball. And they go, baseball. Si. And they go, como se llama? You know, what's your name? I said, Jose DiMaggio. So I started signing Joe DiMaggio. And these guys were looking at me and said, I thought these guys got your signature. I said, they don't have Joe DiMaggio. So if any of the signatures show up on eBay that says Joe DiMaggio, don't buy it. You know, I have kind of a lot of dark humor in my life. And, you know, it's just one of those things. Anyway, I enjoyed it. Thank you for taking your time, and you know, I hope I haven't said anything offensive. Actually, I'm at the stage right now. I'm like a little kid. You don't want to ask me a question because I'm gonna give you my opinion, and it's not always right. It's not always politically correct, but then don't ask somebody that's 70. You're going on 70.
Well, thank you very much for your generous time, and it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jack. Good luck to you.
All right, good luck to you too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.